Case number 21-3722, Scott Creech v. The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation. Or arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Hannah Mullen for the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hannah Mullen. I represent Mr. Scott Creech. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. The department violated the ADA by failing to accommodate Mr. Creech's disability. The ADA is reasonably tailored to remedying and preventing constitutional violations in the prison context, so Mr. Creech is entitled to recover in damages for that violation. Starting with the failure to accommodate inquiry, the department was not entitled to summary judgment because Mr. Creech has established at the very least a genuine dispute of material fact as to each of the elements of a failure to accommodate claim. He is disabled. He is otherwise qualified to take part in the prison's programs.
What's the evidence of disability beyond his own testimony?
Your Honor, there's extensive testimony from his deposition, but then also I think there are three other categories of evidence that I would point Your Honors to, and I'd like to return to the deposition testimony. I'll circle back to that. First, I think there are favorable inferences to be drawn in our favor from the timeline in the case. Everybody agrees that Mr. Creech was issued a cane shortly after he entered prison after being evaluated by an orthopedic surgeon, and he had that cane until 2016. And then he was reissued the cane in 2019 and continues to use it today with the prison's authorization. And so I think we're entitled to the favorable inference that his physical condition was consistent throughout that time period. There's certainly nothing in the record to explain.
And that doesn't meet the statutory definition of disability, though?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's...
I could infer that he had a medical issue or thought that he had a medical issue or somebody else thought he did. But, I mean, we're looking for... you know, a disability under the ADA, right?
That's right, Your Honor, and I think that's where the deposition testimony comes in, and I want to come back to that. And also the medical record dated May 1st, 2019, which discusses his physical condition in a little more detail. The medical record notes that he walks with a limp and assesses a degeneration of the cervical intervertebral disc. And that medical record also notes that the prison medical provider would review Mr. Creech's old record to determine a need for a cane, and he was reissued the cane a few months after May 1st, 2019. So I think we can infer that the medical practitioner looked back at his old medical records, which we unfortunately don't have in the record here, and determined that he needed a cane. But, Your Honor, I think the deposition testimony is important, and I also think it's appropriate for this court to look at it. We know from Morrissey that lay testimony about where a plaintiff describes their own physical condition, not self-diagnosing with a specific medical condition, but just describing their pain, their injuries. That's exactly what the plaintiff did in Morrissey. She relied on her own testimony about struggling to bend over and walk after a day of work, and the court considered that as well as her daughter's affidavit, again, just lay testimony describing the plaintiff's physical condition. And we have very detailed analogous testimony here from Mr. Creech. I would specifically point to pages 500 to 600, approximately, of the record at his deposition, which is record excerpt 66-1. That includes statements like, at times he ached so bad he couldn't hardly walk. It was just out of the question to stand up for long periods of time. If I stand still for 10 minutes, I feel like my back is going to snap.
So what's the case you mentioned before? Is that your best case for saying lay testimony alone is enough?
Yes, Your Honor. It's this court's case in Morrissey.
Morrissey?
Yes. And it's cited in our brief. Specifically, the court looked to the plaintiff's testimony and her daughter's affidavit. The quote, she averred that after an 8 to 12-hour shift, she had difficulty walking, standing, lifting, and bending. And Morrissey's daughter submitted an affidavit in which she stated that Morrissey did not walk or walked with a slight hunch and a pained expression after completing a day of work. So I think that's a neat match to Mr. Creech's deposition here. Your Honor, that's...
If lay testimony is enough, I mean, does this not kind of open up the courts to all sorts of claims? I mean, anyone can just kind of come in and make allegations on their own without any medical expert to support their claims in order to state an ADA claim.
Well, Your Honor, I think the ADA definition of disability is to be construed broadly, and there's no requirement either in this court's case law or in the statute of the statutory text of the ADA or in the regulations that a plaintiff come forward with medical expert testimony or other sort of specialized categories of evidence. That would be a new requirement to layer on top of the statute. But of course, Your Honor, you know, because as this court has explained in, for example, Doe, which we cite in our brief, that the definition of disability is a fact-intensive case-by-case inquiry, you know, whether a jury considers the plaintiff's deposition or other materials credible is up to the jury. But in this case, we have a mix of evidence. We have very detailed, extensive deposition testimony. We have those inferences that we can draw from the 2008 until today timeline. We have the medical records, which again, I know my friends on the other side rely very heavily on the medical records, but I think they pull in both directions here because of that May 1st, 2019 description of my client's physical condition and the fact that he had been issued a cane before. And then there are also...
Let me just ask you, I know you said that there's no requirement for medical proof, but isn't it, not saying Morris, isn't it kind of dependent on... I guess it's the facts and circumstances of the case. For example, suddenly a parent, let's talk about somebody who is somebody who is blind, there are other areas. And then there are other conditions that are not readily apparent. You mentioned the back injury. That may or may not be apparent. Here you say, well, we can rely on the record that he'd been issued a cane before, and so that's substantiated. So my question is, isn't it kind of dependent, as you just said, on facts, and some injuries are more readily apparent than others? And where they're not readily apparent, can't you make the case for a requirement of some medical proof?
Your Honor, I can imagine that making sense in other cases on other records, maybe with other physical conditions being at issue. But I think here on this record, especially in light of Mr. Creech's very detailed description of his day-to-day life and his, to take the ADA's definition at its word, substantial limitation in his ability to walk and stand, I certainly don't think that's this case. And I'd like to briefly touch on the other elements of the failure to accommodate inquiry. Mr. Creech was otherwise qualified to take part in the prison's program services or activities. I think that's a very straightforward element here. My friends on the other side agree that eating in the cafeteria, accessing the law library, accessing the outdoor track and the recreational facilities.
Can you address whether the cane was an objectively reasonable accommodation?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'll go to that prong.
In light of, I think, A, we all agree there are unique security concerns in prison with somebody walking around with something that could be used like a weapon. And B, I think there were some medical... You know, he saw medical professionals throughout his time who didn't recommend that he get a cane or didn't make that assessment. So why is that why does that make this issue kind of not undisputed at this point?
I'll take those two categories of concerns in reverse order, if that's okay. So as to the medical evidence and the nurse practitioner's assessment, I think that goes to the disability prong, which we were just discussing. If a plaintiff is disabled and is excluded from meaningful access to the prison's program services or activities for which he was otherwise qualified, then the reasonable accommodation inquiry kicks in. So if we're doing the reasonable accommodation inquiry, it's because Mr. Creech was disabled. So I think we can leave the doctor's assessments to one side. I think those go to whether there's a genuine dispute of material fact on the disability prong, like we were just discussing. As to the security...
They didn't say that he needed a cane or recommended that he needed a cane or could be given a cane or anything to assist him.
From 2016 to 2019, Your Honor? Again, I think that's relevant to the disability prong.
Why is it not relevant to whether the proposed accommodation is reasonable?
Because...
If the doctors didn't think he needed a cane, why... Would it be unreasonable at that point for the prison to say, well, I'm not going to give him a cane? A, it could be a weapon, and B, the docs aren't telling me I got to give it to him.
Okay, so I'll try my other answer, Your Honor. The accommodation inquiry is a two-step burden-shifting inquiry. This court's decision in Monette at footnote 10, I think, does a really nice job of laying out the structure of how this court addresses it. So first, we bear the relatively light burden as plaintiff to come forward with a facially reasonable accommodation. The magistrate judge, this is at record excerpt 82, page 1014, determined that the department had effectively conceded that the cane would have been cost effective, the prison wouldn't have had to spend another cent to allow Mr. Creech to use it. Other prisoners were using canes between 2016 and 2019. So having established a facially reasonable accommodation, then the burden shifts to my friends on the other side to show that the cane would have been an undue hardship. And, Your Honor, I think this is where your question gets slotted in, is at the undue hardship stage. And undue hardship is a fairly heavy burden for my friends to meet. And I think the most helpful language on this, the Judge Larson's opinion in Keller issued last year cited a case called Wright from the Second Circuit. That's cited in our briefs, and it describes how in order for a prison to establish that a mobility device, it was a wheelchair in that case, but like Mr. Creech's cane, it would have been an undue hardship. It can't rely on general safety concerns, like Your Honor alluded to, you know, sort of canes can be used to hit people. Instead, the department must proffer specific reasons why allowing Mr. Creech to use his cane from 2016 to 2019 would have been an undue burden, and they can't do that here. I think the most compelling evidence that they can't do that here is that he's currently using his cane right now. So,
Counsel, I apologize for bringing this up at the end, but I do want to address. You're not asserting an Eighth Amendment claim at this point.
No, Your Honor, just failure to accommodate.
Are you asserting a First Amendment denial of access to the court's claim?
No, Your Honor, just failure to accommodate.
So. What about the 11th Amendment immunity? I don't know. Was that properly raised below? I'm not sure that he addressed the congruence and proportionality point.
Yes, Your Honor. So the 11th Amendment, his entitlement to damages and the valid abrogation of the state's immunity under the 11th Amendment was raised. You know, the 11th Amendment immunity is an affirmative defense that the department was entitled to raise in its opposition to Mr. Creech's motion for summary judgment. He then responded in his summary judgment reply and response and said that he thought that the Title II of the ADA validly abrogated the state's 11th Amendment immunity. And then he brought it up again in his objections to the magistrate judge's first and second reports and recommendations. So I would point Your Honors to this court's case in Huntington National Bank. That says that, you know, there's no magic words requirement to avoid waiver or forfeiture. And Your Honor's right that my client did not incant the words congruent and proportionality, but he cited Section 5 case law. He clearly argued that the 11th Amendment didn't apply, and it was more than enough to give my friends on the other side notice of his arguments and the court below notice of his arguments, because the magistrate judge at every stage of the sort of back and forth with the district court, and then the district court ultimately addressed the 11th Amendment discussion, so I think it's very much before this court.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Salvatore Messina on behalf of the appellee, the Ohio Department of Rehabilitations and Corrections. I will first touch on the first issue in this case, which is the merits of Mr. Creech's ADA claim, which is I don't believe he has established a prima facie case to show that he was disabled, he was qualified for the disability, or he was qualified for the accommodation that our friend on the other side argued for. And I'll bring you to Mr. Creech's medical records from ODRC. Mr. Creech was evaluated 2016 by nurse practitioner Artrip, who observed him, medically examined him, and indicated that he does not need a cane. He watched him walk in the prison yard, watched him walk around the prison without a cane. He was just fine. He was evaluated several other times in between 2016 and 2019. It wasn't even until April of 2019 that he even complained about his leg injuries and that he needed
a
cane.
What about his own testimony that he's limited in a major life function, basically?
Well, Your Honor, he testified that. He also testified that even after his cane was taken away, he still walked 2 to 3 miles in the yard multiple times a week. He worked a job as a porter, which involves walking around the prison, cleaning. He did all of that without a cane. He also made it to the law library.
He said that he couldn't do it without a cane, but I mean, that, right, the idea is he's in pain. You know, it's uncomfortable for him to walk. I mean, he does it, but I mean, that's still, under the ADA, that still would be a limitation that would be recognized as a disability, wouldn't it?
Yes, but he presents no medical evidence as to where that pain comes from.
Well, right, but that was the whole point of our questioning before, right? Do you need medical evidence? And I'm not sure we've said you absolutely. Look, yeah, most cases you get an expert, you get a treating physician, you get an affidavit, you got all kinds of stuff. In this case, we don't really have it. We have arguably treating physicians who say he's not disabled, and then he testifies himself to things that would perhaps rise to that level. Yes. Why doesn't that create a fact issue?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that his testimony, at one point he testifies that his injuries may have come from kicking a bed during a nightmare. I believe that's in his deposition on page 66-1.
But does it really matter where the injury comes from? Isn't it the case that if there's a limitation in his major life activity, regardless of the result, that the ADA would potentially kick in? So I'm not sure whether the origin of the injury is really controlling.
Well, that's yes, Your Honor, that's correct. However, even through whatever the origin of the injury was, he was still being seen by doctors, by physicians in the ODRC on a regular basis and not complaining about any injuries. From 2016 up until April 2019, his complaints at his medical examinations were based on his shoulder and based on his liver. If you review the medical records, and they're from pages, I think, 939 and 963 in the record, not until the April 2019 examination does he make any complaints about his cane, about needing a cane, about his legs, about walking. Only
okay,
after.
So do you dispute that he has a cane now, and has there been another intervening injury that has resulted in the issuance of the cane?
So I don't dispute that he has a cane now, but if you review, so Dr. Peppers evaluated him on May 1st. This is the May 1st appointment that my colleague pointed out. If you review Dr. Peppers' affidavit, which is, page 923 of the record, she indicates in her affidavit, after examining Mr. Creech and reviewing his past medical records, she believed these, whatever injuries he may have had at that time in May of 2019, to be new pain. She used the word new. She didn't say this pain has been existing.
I want to just go back one more time, and then I'll be quiet. The court's Morrissey case affect your argument about the need for, independent medical testimony?
So I think how you can differentiate Morrissey from this case is that Morrissey, her testimony in that case was that after a whole day of work, she couldn't move, she couldn't stand, she couldn't do anything. Mr. Creech is going about his day working and walking regularly, and it's only 3 years later, after his cane was taken away, that he starts complaining about this pain. So for a whole chunk of time, he doesn't make any complaints that he is substantially limited. Only after the fact, after he files a lawsuit, does he start making all of these complaints.
So it's just really the quality of the testimony and what, I mean, you're saying that he's kind of undermines his own testimony with the other testimony, but is that enough to say that there's not a disputed issue?
I think it's enough to say that it's not a disputed issue.
Does he have an affidavit in this case also?
I don't believe he has an affidavit in this case. I believe it's just his deposition. Which again, I think up until a certain point, up until April and May of 2019, there were no complaints about his injury. about a disability, about anything that he was struggling to do.
So you're saying, I take it, that there's essentially objective indicia, of non-disability versus kind of self-serving statements of disability, and that in that situation, we're not really, a court wouldn't be weighing evidence because, you're just kind of not crediting. It's almost like having a videotape that discredits everything that's said.
I think that's a fair analogy. I think that what's
I'm not sure we can do that, so I don't know if I'd buy it.
I think what's really dispositive about this is that between 2016 and 2019, May or April of 2019, which is the first time, there was the April 25th appointment, 2019, that he started to raise, I don't have a cane, I'm in pain. From between 2016 and 2019, he made no complaints. And only in 2019 did he start complaining again. So I would argue that at least from that time in 2016 to 2019, he was not disabled under the ADA. And medical records show that.
Okay, so aren't those the exact types of things that a fact finder would hear and evaluate and either credit or not credit? At the summary judgment stage, we're just looking at whether or not there is an issue of fact. And what you're arguing right now are those facts. And so those seem to be uniquely in the purview of the fact finder.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that, the first prong of the American Disability Act, yes, he has to establish that he has a disability, and we are contesting the facts to an extent. However, ODRC has a medical policy. It's clear. It's document 74-3, page 926 of the record. An inmate's need for requested accommodation must be medically indicated, which essentially is what the Americans with Disability Act says. You have to have some sort of medically indicated disability. And I think from the record, it's clear, and from the medical records and from even statements out of his deposition, it's clear that there was no medically indicated disability. So I'm not necessarily arguing the facts of whether he had a medical indicated disability. I'm saying that he did not, and there's no evidence that shows that he did.
You're saying that medically indicated disability means that there must be a medical professional who has made that determination. Is that the way you're interpreting that?
That is ODRC's policy, and yes, that is the way that I am interpreting it.
Okay.
What would you address the 11th immunity?
Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, the 11th Amendment immunity, the Supreme Court in the United States versus Georgia set out the procedure for determining 11th Amendment immunity in this type of Americans with the ADA. The first prong, and against what I just argued, is that he has to prove that he had a disability, which obviously is my argument is that he did not. The second prong...
Suppose we conclude he did have a disability.
Okay, so the second prong is that... Did the conduct violate the Constitution? My friends on the other side conceded that there's no Eighth or First Amendment.
Right.
So then it goes to
the third prong.
The third prong of congruence and proportionality. It is obviously our contention that he did not properly raise that. He didn't raise that.
What about the Huntington National Bank that she cited? Is that enough? I think what the court said in that, you don't have magical words that you have to use.
I wouldn't concede that. I think that it was only after the magistrate issued his report and recommendation did he start to, I mean, he argued 11th Amendment maybe after our side brought, after the ODRC brought it up, and then he argued it even more after the magistrate had made his decision and his objection.
You acknowledge that he did raise the 11th Amendment?
I acknowledge that he raised it in his objections.
Okay.
This is an odd situation. You have to raise the defense. You did. And then we're talking about whether he... Can you even forfeit an argument where it would just be a counter-argument to something that you would bear the burden on anyway? I mean, I don't even know if that's a... I don't know whether that's a thing or not. I didn't see any cases on it, but I mean, it's not really a burden shifting, right? I mean, you say, hey, we get 11th Amendment immunity. You still have to prove all of that. have a burden of persuasion. I'm not sure what does he have to do?
Well, I mean, this court in Swain versus Commissioner of Social Security stated that a claim raised for the first time in objections to a magistrate's report and recommendation is waived.
Yeah, but he's not making a claim, right? He's not, the magistrate says, I think there's 11th Amendment immunity, and he says, I think you're wrong. He's objected to what the magistrate has done. What else? I mean, I guess the question is not an 11th Amendment kind of waiver forfeiture issue. It's more of a, what do you have to say when you object to a magistrate's opinion in order to preserve an argument for later? I mean, he's pro se. He mentions that he's contesting the 11th Amendment. I mean, I don't know why that's not enough here. I mean, well, I don't know. I mean,
I would argue it's waived just based on Swain versus.
But you're saying he's waiving the specific theory argument on prong three of the Georgia analysis, whatever, the idea that, hey, this is not constitutional, but it's still within kind of this prophylactic region where we can abrogate still because it would sweep in some other stuff, but that's fine because we're trying to get at an constitutional problem.
Well,
right? Then you're saying he waived that theory or an argument under that on that prong, right?
Yes, that is my argument. And let's just hypothetically say that he didn't waive or the court were to find that he didn't waive it. I don't believe that what my friends on the other side argue the congruence and proportionality of this case would abrogate the 14th Amendment or would abrogate this case under the 14th Amendment. The cases that my friends cited in their brief all go to First Amendment claims, Eighth Amendment claims, stuff that is, you know.
What about the Tennessee versus Lane? One of those cases, a Title II case, right?
It is, but I think in Tennessee versus Lane, I believe, quote me if I'm wrong, that person had a prosthetic leg, so they fit under the First Amendment. They fit under, or the first prong of Georgia. And then, again, I still believe that that is different from what we're arguing here. As this type of case is...
Title II case, I mean, I guess the argument is that it doesn't abrogate, it doesn't say that Title II, that there's an abrogation for all Title II claims. I think that... I can't remember if that was the one, but there was an access to courts issue in that one, right? That
there was. There was an access to courts.
Right.
There's not one here.
So I don't know, but I...
This is also the type of case, again, and I think you pointed it out, Judge Nalbandian, where we're taking Mr. Creech's word as his own self-diagnosis, which his own self-diagnosis is not, I don't believe, is his own self-diagnosis of a disability and a prison theoretically
but you don't
discriminating mean, against him is not
you can a person can say A, B, C, and D, and D could be therefore I have this disease or this whatever, I'm disabled. Okay, fine, you can't do that as a self-diagnosis, but if he says A, B, and C, I can't walk, I'm in pain, I can't do this, whatever it is, that's all okay, right? I mean, we can infer from that, perhaps a reasonable fact finder could infer from A, B, and C that D is true, not even considering his own statement that.
But I don't think that type of case would be congruent and proportional to what they're trying to abrogate here. I think that would open up the courts and the ODRC and any other prison system to a whole slew of cases of inmates trying to say, I have injuries, therefore you didn't reasonably accommodate me, therefore I'm entitled to relief. I don't believe that that is what Congress was trying to do when they were abrogating the ADA.
Okay. Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a few points, Your Honor, on the merits of the ADA question. I think most of the arguments from my friends on the other side come down to casting doubt on my client's testimony, which we know this court can look to under Morrissey, and essentially highlighting that there's a genuine dispute of material fact on the disability issue here.
Is there a dispute that he was working a job, that he was doing all this other stuff? I mean,
no, Your Honor.
About what he was doing, right?
No, but there's a dispute, Your Honor, about whether he was substantially limited in his ability to walk and stand. As to sort of him having good days and bad days, the ADA includes episodic impairment under its a definition of disability. So the question is whether when his disability was active, whether he was substantially limited in his ability to walk and stand. So I don't think it's a silver bullet for my friends on the other side that sometimes he was able to get around unassisted. I would also point there is an affidavit in this case. It's attached to his amended complaint. That's record excerpt 17, page 107. On the denial of meaningful access, just because he was occasionally, again, able to get around doesn't mean that the ADA is satisfied. On the denial of meaningful access point, I would point your honors to this court's case in Keller, which emphasized that requiring a prisoner to endure an excessive or painful effort to access prison services can be a denial of meaningful access, even if he successfully accessed those services. I would also point the court to the underlying cases cited by this court in Keller. So that's Wright, a Second Circuit case, and Jaros, a Seventh Circuit case, that I think are helpful on this point. On the 11th Amendment, briefly on the forfeiture point.
Can you address the question of why your theory wouldn't be an unwarranted expansion under prong three?
Sure, Your Honor.
My concern is we have deliberate indifference law that deals with failure to give medical care. That's the constitutional standard. Why would Congress can't abrogate that, right? I mean, so how would it be appropriate here to recognize abrogation for this claim that would essentially just be a lowering of that standard?
Well, Your Honor, we know from many, many cases in the Supreme Court Section 5 jurisprudence that Congress has prophylactic power, so it can extend its abrogation of the 11th immunity of the 11th Amendment beyond the contours of, for example, the 8th Amendment itself and reach conduct that does not actually violate the Constitution. And then I think Your Honor's reference to Tennessee versus Lane is very, very helpful in conducting the congruence and proportionality analysis here, because I think this case, following closely the model of Tennessee versus Lane in terms of defining the class of cases at issue in this case, and then looking at why Title II is congruent and proportional first.
But why isn't this just like City of Bernie in a way, right? You get Smith, then you get RFRA, and really what RFRA was doing was just altering the burden of what was the exact same claim. And if we do what you want to do, we're taking the exact same claim, which is a failure to give medical care, a deliberate, whatever, an Eighth Amendment type claim, and we're just lowering the standard to what a failure to accommodate under Title II is, which is just a four-prong analysis, much easier, I think, for a plaintiff to win than the constitutional claim. That's basically the same thing that happened with respect to the free exercise stuff, and the court said no.
So, Your Honor, I don't think that's exactly how I would understand what happened in City of Bernie. In City of Bernie, the concern was not only that RFRA protected a broader class of activity than the Constitution itself, which factored into the analysis. I think Your Honor's right about that. But it was also that Congress wasn't legislating against the backdrop of actual state violations of constitutional rights. The court looked at the congressional record and said, you know, we don't think there's actual need for prophylactic activity here. The Congress isn't protecting people against actual constitutional violations by the states. And I think that's where the contrast to Tennessee versus Lane is really helpful here. Because in Tennessee versus Lane, the court went through the same categories of materials that we discuss in our brief, the congressional record, attempts at federal government enforcement by DOJ, cases that we presume Congress was aware of, hearings, reports, and it looked at all of that voluminous evidence and said that the existing legislative backdrop against which Congress enacted Title II was insufficient to protect people with disabilities. As applied to the prison context that's relevant in this case, for example, there was not only the Rehabilitation Act, which was passed in 1973, but also the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, passed in 1980. So Congress had been keeping, it was trying to address the unconstitutional treatment of inmates with disabilities. But when it came time to pass the ADA, they looked out at that landscape and said, people are still getting treated horribly. Unconstitutional treatment of people with disabilities is still rampant. And so we're going to pass Title II to try to be more effective in addressing that. And then on the flip side, in terms of the limitations of Title II's substantive scope, which I think goes a little bit to your concern earlier, Your Honor, I would point Your Honor to Lane's discussion. I believe it's on page 526, but I could be wrong about that, discussing the substantive limitations of Title II's scope. So it reaches only qualified individuals with disabilities, unlike the Eighth Amendment, for example, Your Honor, which protects every inmate. It prohibits discrimination only by reason of disability, so there has to be a causal connection there. And it requires only reasonable accommodations. It's flexible. The state doesn't have to comply with the mandate of Title II in any specific way, and it doesn't require accommodations that would cause an undue burden or a fundamental alteration in a program, service, or activity. And all of this was discussed specifically by the Supreme Court in Lane, and I think it's perfectly applicable to this court's analysis here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, are you handling this on a pro bono basis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you all for representing the prisoner in this case. And I thought the counsel on both sides did an excellent job.
Thank you, Your Honor.